Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparutade sangamatasa tavaraye sotavantabha monjantu satang. So this afternoon, it's a chance to reflect on the way things are. As I often repeat in my talks or reflections, being aware of what you hear affects you, being the awakened awareness rather than the person trying to get something or get caught in some opinion. And of course, this is the beginning of the annual winter's retreat. And so just that, how does that affect you when I say the words, this is the winter's retreat? Yes, that has an effect on your mind. You know, whatever it is, there's no reason to tell you what to feel, but be the owner of what you be the witness to what you're actually feeling. 3 months of formal practice, silent meditation, winter retreat, winter time in England. All these words have their effect on our minds, and so we tend to not notice that, we just operate from habit. And at the beginning of any retreat, there's a lot of restlessness because in ordinary life, there's daily life, there's things to do, duties to perform, work to be done, and on and on like that. So we get caught into the momentum of activity, of thinking, of being caught up in the business of the world or of the monastery, whatever it might be. But then this winter's retreat is usually in the first week or so, there's an incredible sense of restlessness because the habit tendency of the body and mind is to be busy and to be finding things to do, duties to perform. And in kind of formal practice where we practice together, just recognize how supportive it is to meditate together. When everybody's being silent, the whole monastery is in retreat mode, we get the support of a sangha, of the lay community. And the lay community is busy doing the work in the office and the busyness that is part of the worldly experience. But as samanas, as monks and nuns, then of course we encourage the noble silence, the quietness, the stillness. And the English winter is very quiet and still. And so recognize that restlessness is the body and mind. They're restless conditions in themselves, and as long as you're identified with the body and what you think and your emotional habits, then you're going to be very restless, because that's the nature of the body, of the sensual world. It's a restless realm that we experience through this body. And now we're challenging you to see, are you really this restless form, this body, and its restless energies, and the senses, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, the brain, the thinking mind, the emotional habits? Is this really what you are? Is this your... Try to find anything in the body or mind that is kind of permanently self. That's a big question people ask themselves. What is my real self? What am I really? When you get down to the nitty-gritty, the basic reality, who am I? What am I really? Where do I belong? Where do I fit in? So this is an ongoing conditioning, because society tends to want you to fit into it, be conformed to it, to be a member that doesn't disturb the community in general. We want you to fit in, conform, be good. And yet we have to live in a body. We have to experiences through the body, through what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. So experience is very changeable, very uncertain. So when we have this desire to find our real self, you know, we try to find who we belong to, if it's about race or class or nationality or religion. Always, where do I fit in if I'm not a Christian? Or what's happening in Israel and Palestine? Where do the Palestinians fit in? Where do the Jews fit in? Where do they belong? Who's right, who's wrong? So the world itself is very much about right and wrong, good and bad, conformity, non-conformity. And that's restless when you think you're caught between these two extremes in a continuous way for a lifetime, caught in the realm of right and wrong for a lifetime. Then, of course, we create the illusions of I'm a misfit, or I'm a good citizen, I'm a real Brit, or I'm a real American, or I'm a real Buddhist. But Buddhism itself is a condition. So Buddha, remember, never taught Buddhism to his disciples. He taught Dhamma, or the way it is. Dhamma is here and now. And it's not about right and wrong anymore, good or bad. It's about peace, about silence. So on a winter's retreat, one of the benefits of it, one can experience a lot of silence, stillness, as you, during the first week or so, just be aware of the restlessness and not try to just make yourself unrestless, because you can't really do it, but just be patient with the experience of restlessness as you experience it. Like trying to make the body not restless is a hopeless task. Or try to make the mind so that it's concentrated. When you're usually coming from the ego, from sakyaditti, then you want to get the samadhi, stop the thinking, and you get very caught up into wanting stillness, and when you get it, then you want to have it all the time, and you can feel very angry and upset when somebody disturbs you. So these are things to notice. I'm not saying you shouldn't feel this way, but because the human conditioning is such that we identify with everything that's restless. Like the ego, sakyaditti is a very restless conditioning. Or silabhata paramasa, customs, traditions. They're all about right and wrong, proper, improper, acceptable, unacceptable. So being a good Buddhist is good. You know, it's good to be a good Buddhist, is a kind of truism. But good is also a condition, you know, what we imagine, what is good and what is bad, what is right, what is wrong. We're conditioned, educated to believe in concepts of absolute right, absolute wrong. Where silence is here and now. It's not created. It's not good or bad, right or wrong. It is Dhamma. It's the end of suffering. But it's not a forced silence demanding the restless world stop irritating me, but it's here and now, whether you're busy doing something or sitting in the temple meditating, or in your kuti or room meditating, or you're in a meeting or a group, or you're feeling bad, you're sick, and not well, the silence never disappears, except we don't notice it because we're caught up in sakyaditti, silabhata paramasa, vicikicca. So last time I gave a talk, I reflected a lot on sakyaditti, or the ego, identity with the body, and then silabhata paramasa, the conventions, clinging to conventions, cultural conventions, religious conventions, is clinging to conventions. Conventions are that. There's sankharas, and they're restless and changeable. And the third one, which I didn't cover last time, was vicikicca, which is the Pali word for doubt, translated as doubt. And how does doubt arise? You know, what is it? If you're in the silence, surrender to the silence of just being here and now, when you start thinking, then you start doubting. So thinking, grasping thoughts, create doubt. So like intellectuals, people that are well educated and think a lot, and think, you know, they're trying to decide whether God exists or doesn't exist, or what the ultimate purpose of life is, what's the meaning of it all. We can think in very high-minded ways, wanting to find out the meaning of life, the purpose, ultimate reality, or what the Buddha really taught. Did the Buddha really teach what we're told? Or is there a higher form of Dhamma? There's Mahayana Dhamma, and then there's Hinayana Dhamma, and one sounds lesser and one sounds greater, greater and lesser, are concepts which cause doubt. When we perform ceremonies, like sprinkling water, or blessing people, or chanting, chanting the Padimokkha and all that, then the doubt is, for those of us who aren't from Buddhist backgrounds, we think, what's the purpose of a Padimokkha recitation of 227 rules every fortnight, when it's just, you can't even hear it half the time, and just an endless sound of Pali words coming out very quickly. And then we can doubt, we can think, what's the purpose of that when you're reciting 227 rules every fortnight? What good is that? And so that's thinking, isn't it? It's doubt. And we can take a stand. We think, well, it's part of the tradition. We should respect that and carry on. Or we can think, well, it's not necessary. It's just old custom, meaningless. But all these kind of decisions, whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, useful or useless, are all due to the thinking process. And are you really what you think? This is a question to ask yourself. Because thinking is an acquired function. When you're born, you're not thinking. A newborn baby doesn't think about right and wrong, good or bad. So human beings, why we differ from other mammals is that we think. So we can create all kinds of complexities. Otherwise, we just operate through instinct, like the animal world tends to operate through its instinctual intelligence, its procreative energies, its survival mechanisms. And yet we have a mammalian body, just like an ape or a bear or a lion. It functions in the same way. We have the same procreative energies, the same survival mechanisms as all creatures, all animals. But what makes the human being dominant on planet Earth to this day is the ability to think and create with thought all kinds of problems, some of them good, some of them horrible. So are you a thought? Are you your thoughts? Are you your opinions? Like having strong views, righteous views, strong opinions about what right and wrong. And these are causes of war, like the wars in Russia, Ukraine, in Israel, Palestine, is about strong views and opinions, strong identities that are all acquired things. They're all delusive energies that one is attached to and will fight for, die for. We're all kinds of illusions that are created by human beings. Like the animal world, survival is part of its nature. You have to survive in nature, in the jungle. How to survive in a world without laws, without agreements on human rights agreements or anything like that. So it's survival of the fittest. And that's natural to the animal world. And yet, human beings, we don't like to think of ourselves as animals. We think we're special creation above the animal realm. So that's an illusion we are very attached to, that we're better than the rest. So these illusions, you can witness to. We're educated to have these illusions. It's like, don't take it personally, but whatever strong views, opinions you have about Buddhism, about politics, about nationality, about race, about gender, these are conditions that we acquired, that we are attached to and will fight for or stand up for. So it's during this retreat to be able to really just be the witness to your thoughts, to the restlessness that you're experiencing through the form, the physical form that we strongly identify with. Being the witness, the puto, the awakened conscious awareness of the way it is, the body's like this, the thoughts come and go. Like learning to just be aware of thinking, not trying to think about thinking because you get caught, it's an endless trap of the mind. But doubt itself, vicikicca, is because when you doubt, you stop thinking for a moment. What is the meaning of life? And then there's silence, isn't there? What is my real true self? And then we go to psychotherapists, analysts, and ask other people, who am I? What am I really? We'll listen to somebody else tell us. We expect maybe a great teacher, a wise sage, or somebody else to tell us who we are. And we might believe them or we might doubt them. So believing is about believing in concepts, in opinions and views, taking a stand on right or wrong, good or bad. Righteous views are right according to the way you think, what you've been told is right. So we, you know, as a person, we can say, I'm stand up for righteousness, for the real Buddhist teaching, the pure teaching of the Buddha, which sounds very righteous, but it is an opinion. Because the teaching of the Buddha isn't about right and wrong anymore. It's about impermanence. All conditions are impermanent and not self. They're not personal. Who am I? It's a good question. Who am I? And then you want an identity. So there's all kinds of possible identities, like some political identities or religious identities. Gender identities are very dominant now. People want to identify with various gender differences or preferences. So they stand up for what they think is right, what their true identity is some kind of gender, sexual identity. Is that really who you are, a sexual entity? Because sexuality is natural, it's a part of the mammalian condition. You know, it's the energy that we have through the body to procreate the species. So we have to live with it and understand it. Then in samana life, we're celibate, restraint from intentional sexual activities. So that is an agreement when we enter the Sangha we still have sexual energies. We can't stop that or deny it, but we can look at it, recognize it is part of the conditioning. The body is a sexual form. So are you the body? Are you just a sexual form? Or what is aware of sexuality? What is aware of thought, aware of emotion? So mindfulness, the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. So, the ignorant human being, unawakened human being is identified with death. Everything that we've been told we are, what we believe in, is subject to change. To begin, what has a beginning has an ending. So we're strongly attached to what is unsatisfactory, changing, impermanent, will end, will die, will disappear. So there's a lot of fear of death, and human beings are afraid of death because we don't know what happens. Because our experience in this form is in the livered energy of the body. We have to eat and sleep, rest. We have to work. We have to survive as separate forms in the universe. But in the Buddha's teaching, pointing to the awakened consciousness, consciousness that is aware of the impermanence of the physical body, of the emotions, the habits, the thoughts, the memories, that these are changing conditions and they're not self. They're not like, it's, you can't find, if you know, you can attach to a certain identities and hold to that, but that is still not the answer to life. It's a kind of just perpetuation of delusions. So here at Amaravati, the aim of this monastery is to give the opportunity to reflect on life itself as you experience it individually. So in a sangha of samanas, you know, this is a tradition, it's a created form, it's impermanent, had a beginning, will end, but as we use this form, not to attach to, but to look at attachment to form, to be the puto, the aware, awakened awareness in the present moment, because that's where we experience life, it's always here and now. Experience is always now. And the past, we don't experience the past, we remember it. So it's a memory. And we don't experience the future. It's imagined, it's an image of, about something that we expect or dread in the future. Or death, the death of the body. I'm trying to imagine what happens when you die. You can imagine anything. You know, you go to heaven or hell or be reborn in the Deva realms. You'll be reborn and reincarnated into some other form, or you know, maybe if you've not lived a very virtuous life, you'll be reincarnated as a frog or a toad. That's another imagination about what happens when you die. You know, that's about feeling guilty and living a life that is reproachable. But what happens when I die? It's doubt. When the body dies, when I identify with my body and I think, what's going to happen to Ajahn Sumedho when he dies? Just that very question, as a person, he creates it out. Don't know. Yet I could imagine, I've been a good boy for many years now, so I deserve some reward for some auspicious rebirth in. You know, that's what is that but imagination? So imagination is impermanent, you know, has no real essence or heart or core to it. But not knowing is like this, and suddenly the silence resounds. Who is it that wants to know? What is it? Ajahn Sumedho wants to know what is going to happen to his body, to his soul. Does he have a soul, or something that will be reborn? You know, and then of course we can ask various monks or teachers or prophets, and they can tell us all kinds of things we might believe or not. But the reality is we don't know. Not knowing is like this. It's silent. And yet the restless energies that we identify with, always we want to know, we want an answer to every problem, a solution to every problem, an answer to every question. Because that's the way the thinking mind operates. We want definitions. We want words that define experience that we remember or imagine. But here and now is like this. And the silence resounds. It's like the cosmic pulse. And we begin to notice that. We don't notice it when we're caught up in the delusions that we are the body and the personality and our memories and fears and desires. We never notice the... So that even in a silent retreat, we can think, and get all kinds of ideas about life, about oneself, about meditation, about Buddhism, about monasticism. Is monasticism necessary for enlightenment? Do you have to become a bhikkhu in order to become enlightened? Some people believe that in Thailand. Or can lay people get enlightened? Can women get enlightened? I've been asked questions. Can women get enlightened? And one time a woman asked me whether women can get enlightened. I said, I don't know, I'm not a woman. You have to tell me whether they can. Can men get enlightened? And on and on. What are these questions create doubt? Because there's no answer to them. We can say, yeah, men, women, doesn't matter, get enlightened. That's still an opinion or view. The reality is, men and women never get enlightened. It's enlightenment when you see that you're not a man or a woman. When you realize your true nature is Dhamma, it's not male or female, monk or nun. And that's freedom from the prison of the conditioning, the ego, the cultural, social conditioning, the thinking habits of right and wrong. Just, you know, any language has about, it's a created, they're created forms, and they're based on right and wrong, true and false, heaven and hell, God and the devil. So, you know, that's the nature of thought, of any language, whether it's Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, Thai, English, or any other language. It's how we identify ourselves in societies, in the world. We can make laws, we can make moral precepts, commandments, 10 commandments, we can create 227 Padimokkha rules, we can create all kinds of things, human rights, ideas, anti-war movements are all, you know, you can say they're good. Not to want war, to end war is good. But when you look at the history of humanity, of life on earth, it's all about peace and war. Peace is rare, war is ordinary. in any relationship, husband and wife, male and female, or whatever the relationships are, it's not going to be peaceful 100% because of different conditions operating in each individual form. And as long as the individual forms are attached to their individuality, then it's going to clash with somebody else's. And that's just the way it is in terms of samsara, or life in the birth and death realms that we're experiencing. So this is a way to reflect on the actual experience. What you experience, restlessness, is like this. You know, can you as a personality, as an ego, stop your body from being restless or your mind from wandering? You might have the idea that you should. You've been told you've got to settle down, be still, and get samadhi, and stop thinking. And so these are all good ideas. There's nothing wrong with them, but it's not about right and wrong anymore. The path to the deathless is here and now, and it's this direct approach that I identify strongly with the Four Noble Truths. Because the First Noble Truth is a statement. There is suffering. And that's the most obvious experience that we have, whether in the human realm or the animal realm. This realm of samsara, this birth and death realm, is about suffering, unsatisfactoriness, where you can't expect to find permanent peace, permanent love through the forms that you identify with. It's a beautiful ideal. But remember, the form is very unsatisfactory. It gets old, gets sick, dies. It gets cold, gets hungry. We have emotions, we feel experience that we have. So praise, being accepted, being appreciated is like this. Being criticized, being rejected, being unacceptable is like this. The eight worldly dhammas, there's success and failure, happiness and suffering, praise and blame. This is the world that we experience through these forms. And it's never going to be perfect or ideal, because it can't be, because it's basically an illusion that we cling to and maybe never question. So during this winter's retreat, I encourage you to question, investigate. And this is the power of the Dhamma, as the Buddha pointed out, was to investigate, to understand suffering, not to get rid of it. Because in a human form, you're going to suffer. Old age is like this. People get sick. COVID pandemic, there's a lot of suffering. Hunger, there's starvation going on in various parts of the world, and drought, and in Japan recently they had airplane crash and a terrible earthquake. And Japan is probably one of the most well-run countries on the planet. If you've ever been there, it's everything is very orderly, clean, ideal. in terms of efficiency and beauty and democratic society, and on, but still subject to earthquakes, plane crashes, death, COVID pandemics. So even if we can make our societies, you know, perfectly functional, efficient, and peaceful, we still have to live in a universe that we believe is our reality, where all kinds of things, unknown potential possibilities might happen, meteors crashing into the Earth. When you hear about the history of the planet Earth being formed, it's all about violent actions. So violence is the very nature of this realm. You know, as we've lived at a time in my lifetime, there's been almost continuous war, except after the Vietnam War ended, there was a relative peaceful experience, and now it's erupted again in Europe and in Middle East and in Africa, because violence is part of this experience. Violence is part of the restless behavior that we align ourselves with, identify with, that when we think it's wrong, it's not good, it's bad, but it's still part of the samsara experience. So peace or war, peace is good, war is bad. But how can we expect to the conditioned realm to be peaceful forever? It will have moments and then it'll change. Climate change is a concept now that people believe in. And of course, the climate changes. And the history of the past of planet Earth, so planet Earth had a beginning and it will have an ending. There's always predictions of Armageddon, the final resolution, the end of the world. And you can believe in Armageddon, but what doesn't begin and end is Dhamma, here and now. And that's what the Buddha pointed at in his teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the end of suffering. It doesn't mean the end of growing old or getting sick or loss of loved ones or climate change, but it means that you find your true nature is peace, is perfect, is love, rather than this changeable condition of what the human form and our emotional habits and the experiences we have through the sensual world. So see this winter's retreat as an invitation to investigate, you know, not to just shut up and be silent and meditate, but to, you know, really see meditation as much more than just getting concentration, but in understanding, realizing Dhamma. This is the essential teaching of the Buddha, is the Four Noble Truths. After his enlightenment, and according to this tradition, he pointed very directly to suffering, its causes, the cessation, and the way of non-suffering by realizing Your true self is not mortal, bound by conditions. So I offer this as a reflection for today.